Hello, and welcome to There's Hope with Homeopathy. This monthly show airs the third Friday of each month and focuses on classical homeopathic treatment, how it can benefit your entire family, and especially how it can be a curative therapy in the treatment of autism. I'm Amy Lansky, and I'm broadcasting now from Portola Valley, California, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Today's show will air for the first time on March 16th, 2007. Well, hello, everybody. I don't know about where you live, but in California, in Northern California, spring, or practically summer, is really in the air. This week was crazy, global warming and all. We hit 80 degrees on some days. It felt really like summer. A little too early for that, I think. I don't know what the summer will be like here, given this weather now, but hopefully we'll get a little more rain, too. We haven't really gotten enough this year, but I know back east it's been pretty cold. I check the weather every day in Buffalo. That's where my mom, who's going to be 92 in May, I check it every day, see how things are going in Buffalo for her. Anyway, let me give you some current events. There are some things coming up between now and my next show, and the biggest is the Joint National Homeopathy Conference that's put on by the National Center for Homeopathy every year. It always happens in April. This year it takes place April 13th through 17th in Denver, Colorado. And the key part of the conference is on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Friday night, the 13th, and then Saturday, Sunday, the 14th and 15th. Now, if any of you are able, I really encourage you to attend this joint national conference. It is now the joint conference for all professionals and for the public. There's parallel sessions for the general public and advanced sessions for practitioners, although actually practitioners attend both tracks. And the conference is preceded by seminars on Friday and on Monday and Tuesday. That usually is for practitioners, usually go to those seminars. But the whole thing is open to the general public. You can find out more about the conference by going to the website of the National Center for Homeopathy. It's nationalcenterforhomeopathy.org. And you can print out a brochure. I really encourage you to join the National Center as well. I do on every show. I'll just give you a little bit about this conference. The Friday seminar is about the homeopathic treatment of diabetes by one of our one of the world famous practitioners from India, A.U. Ramakrishnan. I talk about him in my book. He's known for his treatment of cancer, but also other really serious diseases. And here he's going to talk about diabetes. On Saturday and Sunday, there's several talks that will be of interest to the autism population. There's going to be talks on vaccine injury and treatment, on the use of genus epidemicus, which I talked about last week, versus homeopathic vaccination, those two concepts. Amy Rothenberg, who's the wife of Paul Herskew, they both treat a lot of kids on the autism spectrum. She's going to be talking about sensory integration disorder. And there's a talk about called Removing Obstacles to Cure, Feeding the Vital Force. It's going to be about proper diet, how diet can be helpful during homeopathic treatment. There's also talks about eating disorders, end-of-life care with hospice patients, miasms, cancer treatment, two-part talk on cancer treatment, which is unusual. I'm really happy to see that at this conference this year. Syndrome X, inflammatory bowel disease, hormone replacement, alternatives to hormone replacement therapy, etc. So it's really a meaty conference this year. The post-conference seminars, there's one a veterinary seminar on Monday for large animals, for agricultural and farm animals, what's called Homeopathy in Organic Agriculture and Farm Animal Health. That sounds really cool because of the use of homeopathy instead of drugs for animals. And there's a two-day seminar by Henny Hudens Maast, who is one of our also famous international teachers from the Netherlands, who's an expert. She often talks about miasms, and that's what she's going to talk about. I know there's been a lot of talk about miasm theory on various homeopathy lists with the parents wanting to learn more, and I think I'll give a talk about miasms in one of my shows. But I don't talk about it much in my book, but it's basically it's a homeopathic word for disease tendencies and also a homeopathic way of categorizing remedies into certain classes, so that if a person has a certain kind of disease tendency, we know it's more likely that they'll need a remedy from this class of remedies associated with that miasm. Anyway, okay, so that's the news. Oh, and the other big news, in less than 2 weeks, the National Center for Homeopathy website is going to be completely changed, which is an exciting event for me because I've been working on this project personally as the head of it for 2 years. And if you go visit the website now, you'll see one that's kind of old-fashioned and disorganized. And in 2 weeks, if you check it out, it's going to be brand new, modern, and an incredible, much better benefit for the NCH members. So I'm excited about that. For those of you who are tuning in for the first time, I always review this. This show is based on my book, Impossible Cure, The Promise of Homeopathy, which is one of the best-selling patient education books in the country and also is used as a textbook at the homeopathic schools. And so I encourage all of you, everything I talk about is contained in this book. So to find out more, go to www.impossiblecure.com. Also on my website are tons of resources that you'll find helpful to you. There's a page about autism treatment. On that page, too, is our referral list to practitioners. There's the Cure Stories database, which is a database of stories contributed by others about autism cures and cures of other things, too, and I encourage you to contribute yours. You can find out how to order Impossible Cure, including bulk orders. And there's also a link to from the homepage on the right side, you'll see a link to the archives of this show, and it's free. You can listen to this show. There's, I guess, about 24 shows, something like 24 shows now, that provide you with a free short course on homeopathy. And lately, I'll alternate content shows where I'm just talking with interview shows, and today is one of those interview shows. And also feel free to email me with your questions or a question or desire, if you want a referral to a practitioner. My email is Lansky@impossiblecure.com, or through Autism One, you can email me at alansky@autismone.org. So, as I said, today's show we're having an interview with homeopath Tim Shannon, ND, who's a naturopathic physician but who only practices homeopathy in Portland, Oregon. Next month, I'll probably report briefly about the national conference, but the focus is going to be a continuation of last month's show, which was about different methodologies of homeopathy. And this next month, I'll be touching on things that do kind of veer away from classical homeopathy, including talking about organ remedies, cell salts, and sequential therapy. I know a lot of you want to learn more about that. But as you know, this show, and I personally advocate classical homeopathy. Okay, so I guess that's it for this moment. Okay, let me begin introducing you to Tim Shannon. And when I'm done, I'm going to put you on pause. I'm going to call him up and we'll bring him on. Okay, so some of you listening may be participants in the Homeopathy for Special Needs Children Yahoo group, and I do encourage all of you to join that. You can find out more by going to homeopathysnc.org. And Tim Shannon is one of the homeopaths who participates in this email forum. He's a licensed naturopathic physician. As I said, he has a private practice in Portland, Oregon. And he also serves as an adjunct faculty at the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland. Dr. Shannon specializes in the treatment of mental, emotional, and behavioral health. So his practice tends to focus on people with all kinds of difficult mental health complaints, including the autism spectrum, but also ADHD, of course, which is on, many would argue, is on the autism spectrum, OCD, learning disorders, Tourette's, depression, anxiety, addictions, eating disorders, self-harm, post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar, and schizophrenia, which I'm going to ask him about because my own brother is schizophrenic, so something of interest to me. I've met Tim, and he's a really sweet and thoughtful person. I met him, I guess, when the National Center for Homeopathy's conference was in Portland. And I think he gave a talk there, actually. And I'm not sure if he gave a talk on autism treatment. I can't remember what he talked about. It was one of, I think it was about just some cases in general. I don't think it was autism cases. Anyway, he's also done some pro bono work for the world. He was invited to establish an AIDS clinic in a slum in Nairobi, Kenya, in the summer of 2000. So he went there, and the clinic was designed to treat AIDS patients who didn't have any other health care. He trained local Kenyans in the use of homeopathic medicine at the clinic, and for this work, he won a what's called a Brant Ashton Scholarship for his role in establishing this clinic. So he's also a humanitarian. So without further ado, let's call up Tim and let's talk to him. Okay, we're back now with Tim. How you doing, Tim?
Good.
Thanks.
I'm doing good. How you doing, Amy?
Okay, thanks for joining us on the show. So as you know, most of the parents who listen to the show are parents of autistic kids, and I know you have many autistic kids in your practice.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? What percentage would you say of your practice are kids on the spectrum?
Probably 15-20%.
So it is quite a few.
Yeah.
It is quite a few. And I've told people how, your practice focuses on issues, mental issues, behavioral issues, mm-hmm. very difficult chronic problems, really.
Right.
So that's really interesting. How did you get interested in that? How did you get interested in homeopathy?
Let's see. Well, I got interested in homeopathy, I think, like a lot of people, just to heal myself. Many years ago, I was suffering with quite a bit of depression myself. This is maybe 25, 30 years ago, I think. And just kind of, someone mentioned this homeopathy stuff, and I didn't really know much about it, and I went to see this guy and had one of these kind of typical miracle responses where the guy gave me something and then pretty much everything cleared up. And that kind of started it. That kind of intrigued me, I guess. So that was how I kind of got interested. And then I think what really caught me actually wasn't even my own improvements from homeopathy. It was actually reading reading cases of cured patients. Probably about 17 or 18 years ago, I was at the naturopathic clinic's library, and I was reading some of these cases, and a few of them moved me to tears. I was just so moved by some of those cases that I became a bit obsessive about it, actually.
Were you in the naturopathic school then?
No, I wasn't. I actually was far away from me. I'd take the bus, and or I drove. I can't remember if I had a car at the time, but I'd go out there in the afternoons just to sit in the library and read the cases. So
wow.
I got kind of hooked by it. So that's how I got interested in it.
What were you doing at that time? Were you in school or?
Actually, I was working with children. I worked with several different agencies here in Portland that treat neglected children, children that have been abandoned, that kind of thing. I worked in counseling them and also at different shelters and that kind of thing.
So you've always worked with this population. That's really interesting.
Well, not always, but for a while.
Even before you studied, you know, homeopathy.
Yeah.
So what do you think, I mean, what brought you to that interest in that community and mental health?
You know, that was kind of an organic process, because when I was at school at the Naturopathic College, they had, one of the great things about the Naturopathic College is they have a lot of what they call satellite clinics, where you can treat really a big variety of different kinds of patient populations. And there were two. The first one I ever got to work in was a clinic that treats what they call dual diagnosis patients, so patients that have mental disorders like schizophrenia or bipolar, or they're delusional, but they also have some kind of addiction, some drug addiction or something. And that's kind of how I cut my teeth. In my first year in school, I was, through some kind of strange divine providence, I guess, I was allowed to have my own private shift working with these patients.
Wow.
Which was unusual, because usually you don't get to see patients until, I think, your third year, and I was already seeing them in my first year, and they were...
And they're hard patients.
Yeah, they were difficult patients. But I've always had this kind of thinking, I don't know how correct it is, but if you really want to learn something fast, then you have to go for the hard road or something. And I can't tell you that that's true or not, but that's how I came about that.
Wow.
And then shortly after that, they put me into another clinic treating bipolar and schizophrenic patients. That was an outpatient facility. And I started seeing some miracles. I mean, cases of people that had been, you know, severely schizophrenic starting to turn around, or bipolar patients. And
were they also on meds?
Yeah, they were all on meds. But one of the things you learn about patients that are in that grouping, you know, true schizophrenia and bipolar, is that many, well, at least a lot of the patients that I saw, they don't really get much benefit from the drugs. That's a controversial statement, but a lot of the patients, pretty much all the patients I saw, were living some very sad lives. Maybe they modified some of the extremeness of their symptoms, but that's about the best that those drugs were doing for them.
I am very familiar with this, because, you know, my brother is schizophrenic, and he's, you know, been medicated his whole adult life. He's 53,
sure.
And he's living in a sort of a, it's a long story, but he's living in a facility of a kind of, an open facility.
Yeah.
And so I agree. I mean, he's one of the harder cases, you know. But his, you know, the delusional and the, you know, crazy behavior is subdued, but it's complete suppression, you know.
Right.
So he's kind of like a zombie, very disabled, you know.
Yeah. They don't have any kind of recovery from what I've seen now. But I have to kind of say that most of the cases that I saw in that facility were completely non-functional people. I mean, they were severely ill.
Yeah.
But I saw, like, one of my first patients there was a woman that she had very clear religious schizophrenic disorder. I mean, in the sense that sometimes in schizophrenia they have the more classical format where they kind of have religious strong thinking, and this woman had very clear ideas that the devil was in her bed and all this kind of really scary things about heaven and hell and this kind of idea.
And those are symptoms right in the homeopathic repertory.
Yeah, and a matter of fact, she had been treated, that clinic, they had other students there before me who had treated her with stramonium and so on, which didn't really do much for her.
Huh.
And so, I mean, she had some minor improvements, and everybody was excited that she got some improvements, but it wasn't that really significant. She was quite overweight. She was on risperidol, I think, if I remember correctly. And so I did a differential and gave her a remedy called Mancinella, which is not that rare a remedy, but not too common either.
Yeah.
Within a few months, that delusion of the devil started completely going away. She lost about 50 pounds.
Wow.
She had a dramatic improvement. That was one of my first that really made me see, wow, if you can find a precise remedy for these people, you can really see miracles for them, you know.
then we'll get into autism. But one thing that's hard with this community is keeping them, you know, getting them to keep coming and doing the homeopathic treatment. This is something my brother won't do, for example.
Yeah. No, what I was just about to say is a caveat with treating severe mental illness is often what you just said. I mean, number one, it's very hard to get them to stay in treatment long enough to get the deep, pervasive changes that are possible for them. It's much more common that they either run out of money, they start missing appointments. I mean, there's just a number of case management issues that come up with dealing with this population. As a matter of fact, that's what got me so interested in autism. It's because I saw the potential with schizophrenia and bipolar, but I was very frustrated in just trying to get these people to stay on task and get them better. Whereas with autism, the parents are fiercely committed to their kids. And they have the same kind of potential turnaround. And you actually get to watch them do it. So it's much more satisfying.
And you change... You really change the course of a whole person's life from the beginning.
You do that, but you also change the whole family's life.
Right.
You know, so it's very satisfying. Whereas with schizophrenia, it's a tease, because you see someone, they come back and they say the delusions are gone, but then they mysteriously disappear, or their father stops paying, or, you know, it just becomes crazy-making, you know?
Yeah, I understand.
So autism is a pleasure to work with for that reason, because... You get to see the potential of homeopathy and what it can really do.
So tell me, for the benefits of the parents here, tell me about what it's like when you first bring in a family. What can they expect? Well, how do you prepare for the case? Do you have them do, intake thing? What do you do when you first get an autistic child in your practice?
Well, I have a waiting room and an office where I see the patient, and usually, if it's possible, my preference, there's no preparation, they just show up. I mean, we just make an appointment and they show up, but essentially they come in, and I tell the parent that I want to see the child by themselves while the parent is in the waiting room. Now, that's not always possible, because for some kids that's just not going to be realistic. But it's true in many of the cases that I actually see the child first, and I want to see that they don't talk, or they do, or if they mumble, or, you know, I want to see that without the benefit of the parent. And then also, vice versa, I'd like to have the child out in the waiting room while the parent's there telling me the birth history, when the symptoms began, the vaccination issues, all that stuff, and what are the current issues. And the reason why I like to separate the parties is because oftentimes a parent won't tell you he does this, or he bit his sister, or he can be malicious, or, you know, whatever it is, if it's not a nice thing. They're a little bit hesitant to say it in front of the child. Now, that's not always the case, and I always explain this to the parent and give them a choice. And sometimes they say, oh, it's fine if he's here or she's here. And sometimes they say, no, actually, that's a good idea. So... That's one kind of piece that I put in play that's an option for the parents. And then what happens is, you know, for me, I just need to get the case. I need to get the information from either the parent or the child, or a little bit of both, depending on how that works itself out. And then, then I get the case from, you know, as I said, either one or both. And then at the end, we set what's called a baseline, which is just writing down a real simple list of what are the behaviors, what are the chronic symptoms, like do they have echolalia, are they having problems with pronouns, are they, do they have sensitivity issues with sound, do they have food issues or not. So we itemize those. So if they have sensitivity to noise, is it like a constant, like they can't take light or sound, or they're super sensitive to smells, or some things they can, like you'll notice some kids, you know, they can take loud music if they play it themselves, but not if somebody in the house plays it. So we'll itemize out all those symptoms. Then we'll get them started on the dosing. And that'll also include symptoms like if the child is on an inhaler and they have asthma, I want to know how often they need it. If it's a PRN, so if they take the asthma dose, you know, as needed, how many, you know, roughly how many times a week is the child needing that asthma inhalant. And then, so the utility of having that whole list in front of me is that a lot of times the parents go away and they have several kids and they're just washed away back into their life, and they, even though they're focused on their child, you know, because they can't not be, some of these things aren't really on the forefront for them. And then when they come back for the follow-up, we start reviewing those baseline symptoms and say, okay, he was using the inhaler, you know, 3 times a day or 3 times a week. How is he now? And then the parent will say, wow, I forgot about that. Actually, he hasn't been using the inhaler.
Right. You wouldn't believe how many people don't think homeopathy did anything, and because they just don't remember.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, either that or they'll remember, yeah, now, you know, before he was very cold, now he's actually asking me for hugs, or he says, I love you, Mom, which shocked me, or, you know, they remember that stuff. But oftentimes some of the other things aren't on their radar, and for me, I want to see if the whole case is responding. Even symptoms like nail biting or scratching at their knees, or, you know, things that for the parent, it's not as significant as whether they're being affectionate or where they're saying more words than just water, please, or, you know. And so that's my purpose in doing that. And then the other thing is that baseline or that tracking that we do also kind of, again, after the whole case has been taken, helps the parent look through, and sometimes they'll remember, oh, I forgot. He also has migraines or, you know, whatever it might be. And they're this many times a week. So it gives me a chance to be very comprehensive and then to make sure every time the parent comes back that we're really progressing on the whole case. Because a lot of times we all, me included, want to believe that the remedy is right and it's working. But if certain things aren't happening, I'm pretty sure it's not working or it's not precise enough. So that's why I do that baselining.
Now, do you see, I know a lot of parents are focused just on the talking, but like, do you see a particular pattern of response in successful cases? I often tell them the talking may come much later. What is your experience?
You're talking about whether or not, you know, like if they have problems with articulation or they're not talking much at all or mumbling,
yeah.
How soon I see improvements, you mean?
Yeah, or do you see a particular pattern of response, like other things will improve before that, you know, what kind of, or is it just so individual you can't say?
You know, that's there was a time when I used to say it took more time, but I've had times now where I've given a certain potency, like what's that girl, there was a girl recently where that happened, where we changed, no, I'm sorry, it was a boy, this boy in Washington, we gave him a single, he had been managed on low doses and liquid, which were working. But there were some things that were stalling, and so I just switched him and just gave him just a single pellet of a 30C of his remedy, which is a remedy called Mandragora. And he had dramatic turnaround. I mean, of his speech and everything, within a day.
Oh, wow.
I mean, the parents, the teachers at school called him up and said, what did you do with the boy, you know?
Potency can really make a difference.
It's kind of mind-boggling. It's, you know, there's a lot of symptoms that I used to think that, oh, these take a long time, and then I see you change something, and then, whoa, wow, like fast improvements.
It's sort of, you know, we're taught in homeopathy school that potency is not nearly as important as the remedy, and maybe that's true, but potency really does make a difference.
Well, it does make a difference, but on the other hand, it's definitely true that getting the right remedy is primary.
Yeah, it is.
Obviously, the potency means nothing if the remedy's wrong.
Right.
So that's the first step. But then, yeah, I've had cases actually where I've given a 200 with a kid and then said, oh, God, nothing happened or nothing much happened. You know, and I waited 6 weeks or something. And then I looked at, you know, I kind of puffed away for months with the patient, and then I looked back over the chart and I said, God, you know, that remedy really looks like it was right, and I gave a very low dose, and it was immediate improvement.
Huh.
And then it turned out to be the right remedy after all.
Is there any particular dosing that you favor with the autistic kids?
Well, I definitely prefer using the liquid doses now that I've learned about them. I'm really just learning about them. I just started, actually, Deborah Vidal did a whole thing on them at the NCH last year. And I actually wasn't at the talk, but I talked to her later, and she kind of gave me the lowdown on it because I was getting a little frustrated about some of my cases, some of the dosing thing, and I wanted to kind of hear it from her. And so we sat down and talked about it a little bit, and I started experimenting with it, and I saw some dramatic, I mean, really dramatic turnarounds.
I think.
I mean, I still see dramatic stuff with 200s and 1Ms, but it's kind of amazing how wonderful it is using those low liquid doses.
I think there's something to be said, too, for, like, then the parent is, like, is you know, actively doing something every day and is monitoring things in a different way. I think it engages the parents and the child on a psychic level as well. I think that also contributes. I know that with my son, when we were giving him the LM dose every day, it was sort of like a spiritual activity, and that can only help in a way.
Sure.
And also, you know, I think that, you know, these kids need, I don't know, they need this kind of slow nudge back, I think.
Right.
Not all of them, but a lot of them, because it's like, this is sort of more from a spiritual point of view. They're like in this other world, and that they're afraid to come into our world.
Sure.
So it's better to be gently led back than pushed back somehow. This is just my feeling.
Yeah.
And I think it also depends, there's all different patterns, you know.
Right.
Of the type of autistic kid. I'm curious if what you feel, have you seen any ingredients that have made some cases successful more than others, like anything about the family, the kid, yourself? Have you noticed anything like that?
Wow, that's a good question. That's a great question, actually. Well, for sure with myself, there's always a humbling that happens with the cases that I can't find the remedy right away. With those cases, they always teach me that what I know, you know, what I've seen before with other cases that have been successful, or, you know, what I understand from the books and so on, is not as important as going back to this individual patient, this individual child and his or her family, and looking deeper again. And sometimes I'll have made a simplistic or superficial kind of assumption about the child, or something about how he, you know, he does this or that, and then I make this assumption, oh, that means it's under this rubric or this idea or this family of remedies. And then sometimes, you know, if the case has failed once or twice, I'll go back and I'll say, you know, after one or two different remedies I've tried, I'll go back and I'll say, okay, I'm missing something. And then when I review it, something will reveal itself that I just didn't see before. And since that happens occasionally, I've learned to always even be suspicious of my own thinking process, which sounds a little crazy-making, but it helps you to always keep growing. It helps you to always go, okay, I expected more from this, you know, this particular remedy or this, you know, but something's not right. It's not working the way I would expect. There's some improvements, but it's not what I know is possible. And so then I go back and I do the work, and then we get a miracle, you know.
What about the family?
Lesson. What's that?
What about the family? Is there something that they can do to improve the chances of your success?
I think most of the cases that I see, the families are so committed, they're already given everything they can. I've heard people say, oh, the parent didn't tell me this. That really doesn't happen much in my cases. People usually give me the case, you know. I think the parents do good work there. I mean, there are certain populations of other kinds of conditions that I treat where the parents don't follow through or they flake out on appointments. But that's not true for the most part with most of the autistic patients and their parents that I see.
What about, do you treat the whole family? Do you find that helps? Or
that's something that I've actually had cases that I couldn't solve the kid until the parent came in, and then I solved the parent, and all of a sudden I thought, oh my God, look at this. I never even thought of that remedy before, and I saw the remedy for the child, and the case is, you know, is doing great. I've had that happen several times, but practically speaking, a lot of families are already tapped out financially. So for them to have me see one or two of the parents for, you know, for their migraines or whatever they have, on the chance that it might help me find a remedy for the kid, is, it's not as common. So I wish I had more cases where I could do that, but it doesn't always happen, you know.
So I know that you're a naturopath, so, I mean, and you know these families come in with their kids on a million different regimens and stuff. What is your feeling about diets, supplements, other treatments, how they interact with homeopathy, what's good, what's not?
Well, it's true that I'm a naturopath, but I don't really function as a naturopath in the sense that I don't really do the diet counseling. I order labs for people where there's something that I have to follow with somebody. You know, like if they have arthritis and I have to check their sed rate or something. But other than that, I don't really use a lot of the naturopathic tools for the most part. Mostly I just do homeopathy. That's plenty for me. In terms of people come in on already a treatment or multiple treatments, that's never been a problem for me. The only, you know, if they're, and it, as an example, a lot of these kids come in on the GFCF diet, right? And that's a real common intervention. Or they get cranial sacral, you know, that's another common popular treatment. But most of the time they're coming because despite the fact that they're on the GFCF or they're getting cranial sacral or they're doing so many of the other treatments, chelation, et cetera, there are either those treatments are doing anything or they're helping. You know, in many cases they've helped a lot, but there's still a lot to be desired. And so in those cases, I just tell them, that's fine, maintain what you're doing. Just don't make any changes in that. And then we're going to start them on the homeopathy. So there's only one variable that's changing. So when they come back for a follow-up, we can clearly assess if there's changes, where it's coming from, because there's only been one change that's made in their routine. The only time that that can become a challenge is if the parent comes in, like I've had kids where, parents where they brought the kid in, they were so desperate, because a lot of these kids, you know, they're really suffering and the families are suffering. And so you start them on the treatment, and the parent, without your knowledge, goes out and does two or three other treatments at the same time, you know, with an earnest desire to just help the child. And then when they come back, they're a lot better. We don't know why. My remedy could have had nothing to do with it. And if those treatments that they're giving are superficial and the improvements are short-lasting, then we're wasting time in terms of the homeopathy. So in those kind of cases, I usually, if there's a conflict like that, I usually tell the patient, look, you have to make a choice to do one or the other treatment until you figure out what it's doing, so that you can, I don't know, this is a complex question. Is it making
sense? No, that's fine. No, it's good. I'm also curious if you've ever seen things like, I've heard this from other, you know, practitioners, that like the parent gets impatient with the progress. That's also a very common thing. And then we'll say, oh, I got to do chelation.
I can't hear you well.
Oh, I'm sorry. Have you ever had cases where the parents get very impatient?
Yeah.
And say, I got to do chelation, and then a lot of the gains with homeopathy are undone. Have you ever seen anything like that, or?
It sounds like it might have happened once or twice. It's not common. I've had patients that tell me, look, you know, we are seeing gains and this is great, but I really feel like I have to do something else too. And if it's something comprehensive like chelation, I will tell them, I think you're better off stopping the homeopathy. I don't say they have to do this, but I'm pretty strongly going to encourage them to either do the homeopathy or do the chelation. And if they do the chelation, they're welcome to come back and see me. But I think to try to track two treatments that have the potential, I don't know what real potential chelation has, other than what some people have told me a little bit. But I know what homeopathy tried the chelation or whatever it is, and then we just resumed treatment, and they kind of got that out of their system. And some of them haven't gotten back, so maybe they got what they needed. So does that kind of answer your question?
Yes. Okay, so what about, have you had any older autistic kids, not just Asperger, but, you know, older autistic kids? Have you had any success with them?
Well, that's a tough question. Because when you say autistic, you said not Asperger's.
Well, okay, so let's say, but still not speaking.
Okay.
Like low functioning.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a much rarer group of patients for me. I have 3 boys in my practice. And one of them I've been treating for years. And we've had some improvements. He's 17 now. Had some improvements, but nothing compared to what, and I've never found the remedy for that boy. That's been a very difficult case. I've found great success with his sister, who's not autistic at all. She has some pretty not so fun behavioral issues, but she's had a lot of wonderful gains. But with the brother, I haven't had good success. And I'm not saying, you know, that I found the right remedy. It didn't work. I can't find the right remedy for the boy. It's a very odd case.
Yeah.
A difficult case for me.
Is he still with the family, or is he in an institution?
No, he's with the family.
Oh, he is.
He's with the family. He's very low functioning. He's more of the true classic autistic case. And then I have a small boy who I've had some hard time finding his remedy, but I think we actually got that solved right now, but it's too soon to know. But in general, that's much less common in my practice. What I call true autism, where they don't talk, they don't want to be touched, they have the severe obsessions, this kind of thing, I really don't see many of those. I see much more of the Asperger's cases, where, you know, they do talk, but it's not very pronounced, or they talk perfectly well, but have other strange, odd behaviors. That's way more common in my practice.
Do you use... isopathic remedies for the vaccines, anything like that? Is there, or do you find certain types of remedies that are more helpful than others?
I when you say isopathic, you're saying giving carcinosin or giving vaccine remedies?
Vaccine remedies, yeah.
No, I've never done that.
You've never done that.
And I'm not in a place to comment that it's a wonderful thing or not. I've heard people say they've seen miracle stuff with it, so... I don't know. I just know. I know what I can do with the classical format, and I'm pretty clear about that. So for me to start trying this other kind of stuff just feels like it would be, you know, I don't have expertise in that, and I feel like I'd be experimenting, and it's too late for me now to start that down that road. So if people are getting good results with that, that's great. I don't really care how people get results. If they get great results, wonderful.
Have you found certain, like, classes of remedies? Some practitioners have found animal remedies. Some have found drug remedies. Is there any, or is it you just haven't found any particular class that's...
Well, I have to say that I think it's entirely unpredictable. It's a completely open window. I have to start out by saying that. Because I have a kid now that's been completely, I hate saying the word cured, but... I mean, he doesn't really have any kind of PDD issues at all anymore, and he had some pretty significant ones. And he's done really wonderful on this medicine that comes from the bug of a parasite that lives on a cactus. And that was a remedy that I was able to solve because the father came in.
This is Coccus cacti?
What?
Coccus cacti?
Yeah. Which is...
Yeah, you'd never think of that.
Yeah, it's a very strange remedy. I mean, and to be honest with you, the way I got to the case was a very strange, circuitous route. but in any case, that's one case that I have. I have another case of a remedy called Lactuca, which is kind of like a very mild type of opiate that comes from a wild lettuce, which is another kind of oddball remedy that you wouldn't really know to look for. I'd already seen an adult case of that remedy years ago, so I kind of knew it when I saw it, so it wasn't that difficult a case because I'd had experience with it. But I think that would have been a hard case maybe for somebody who didn't know that remedy, you know, because it's just an oddball.
Yeah, I think I don't know anything about that remedy.
Yeah, I have lots of very successful cases with very odd remedies. But now when you say what's common, I have to say the nightshades are common in the autistic spectrum.
Right.
And then you have to know how to look for them. And it's not just stramonium. You have to know how to differentiate between tobacconum, dulcamara, mandragora, and stramonium and capsicum. Those are all in the same family. Unfortunately, a lot of times these kids get stramonium or belladonna occasionally or hyoscyamus, and that's it.
Right.
Meanwhile, the child, you just step over it, and they need dulcamara, and it cures the whole case. They start speaking, the whole thing turns around. So you have to have literacy about the whole realm of the nightshades. But the nightshades, you have to know them if you're treating kids in the spectrum because they're common.
Do you use Sankaran's methodology at all?
I don't know that methodology. I mean, I've heard of it, but, you know, again, like what I said before, I feel like I know this Italian homeopath Massimo's method very well, and I've used it with very good success. And I feel like it just doesn't work to switch horses and learn a whole new system unless you're going to go to all the classes and really learn it, and I'm done with all that.
No, I understand.
You know, I mean, everybody who's using it says it's a miracle, but I see miracles all the time, and how am I going to judge that that's really superior, that that's going to make a huge difference when I already see, I'm already constantly learning through this method, you know?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're doing great work. So, you know, we have like maybe a couple more minutes.
Sure.
So is there any I want to ask you about the AIDS clinic in Nairobi. But before we do that, I want you to, if there's any other message you'd like to give to parents before we conclude this discussion.
I think the biggest thing I want to say just from my heart is that don't ever give up. My God, it's a beautiful thing that can happen to these kids. I mean, it's so moving to be able to get to do it. That's the biggest thing. I mean, I think they're totally right. I think these parents don't give up on their kids, and don't ever let anybody tell you to give up because they can get so much better.
I agree. That's why I do this show.
Yeah.
And so tell me, you did this AIDS clinic. What kind of successes have you heard about with AIDS in Africa?
Well, in the few, I don't know how many minutes we have left, but it's probably one of the most beautiful experiences I've had in my life because, I mean, for so many reasons, it's hard to describe, but, you know, I saw cases of people who were so ill that we never get to treat in this country because all these people go to the hospital. These were people that were barely walking, that had renal failure, that were spitting up blood. I mean, severe cases. That really should be an ER. And I saw many of those cases be completely turned around within a matter of days with the right remedy.
With just remedies.
What's that?
With just homeopathic remedies.
That's all they had. They had no money. They lived in the slums. It was a real lesson for me about how dramatic you can turn around cases of tuberculosis, renal failure, severe cases. Now, they called it an AIDS clinic, and one of the things you have to understand about Africa is that there isn't a lot of money to test that these patients have AIDS. So a lot of times when these patients come in and they have a certain profile, they're considered to have AIDS. And that's what a lot of those patients were, you know, they were, you know, there was a whole long waiting line to see me, and they were there all day, every day, and they were all referred from the AIDS clinic in Nairobi, and you know, they had diarrhea, they had a lot of these symptoms that you see in AIDS, but I'm sure some of them had AIDS, but I think some of them were syphilis cases and some of them were tuberculosis cases too. I don't know how you could know that because none of them were tested. There was no money to test these people.
Right.
So you have to understand that when they say that there's this huge problem with AIDS in Africa, I'm sure it's true, but I don't know how much of that they know is really AIDS. So for me, whatever the person came in with, I treated them for whatever their symptoms were and tracked to make sure that the symptoms went away.
Wow, that really speaks to the power of homeopathy. That was like the biggest proof you could ever have.
It's the biggest what?
The biggest proof of homeopathy to turn around cases like that.
Oh, God, it was a gift. I couldn't wait every day to get there. I had to get up at 6 in the morning to take a 2-hour bus to get there, and then every night I had to work by candlelight because I didn't have any lights with whatever my laptop battery had to crack the cases from the day before. And I every day I was on adrenaline every day. I was just so in love with it. It was just a beautiful thing to get to do. I mean, I couldn't say enough that for homeopaths in America, the opportunity to treat third world patients is a beautiful gift.
That's amazing. All credit to you, Tim. So, that's amazing.
Yeah, no, I hope to do it again someday.
Well, thank you for all your work for this community.
You're welcome.
And
your work.
Thank you. So, I guess I'll be seeing you on the homeopathy SNC list.
All right.
And thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, that's about all we have time for today, and I also wanted to tell you, I never told you about Dr. Shannon's email and website. It's Dr. T. Shannon, it's drtshannon.com, and his email is drt@drtshannon.com. I just want to encourage you all again, too, to visit the ImpossibleCure.com website. Also, the Homeopathy for Special Needs Children Yahoo group, which you can find out about at homeopathysnc.org. And also visit the site, soon to be new site, of the National Center for Homeopathy.org. So, be well, and remember, there truly is hope with homeopathy.